This is the Smithport Podcast covering news and events around the borough. On Thursday, October 15th, the McKean County Historical Society held its annual fall dinner. The event featured guest speaker Dr. Richard Frederick, Director of History at Pitt Bradford University. In his talk, Dr. Frederick asked, "Is there anything we still don't know about Lincoln?" This after 16,000 volumes written about the 16th president since his death in April 1865.
About 75 years ago, the leading Lincoln expert in the country was probably an academic historian named James G. Randall. And Randall published an article, a journal article, and posed the question, has the Lincoln theme been exhausted? In other words, 75 years ago, there was already so much written about Abraham Lincoln, he's thinking, well, you know, is it time to just stop and basically not write about Lincoln for a while? He said at the time, and this is again 75 years ago, that the subject of Abraham Lincoln was probably the most overworked in American history. But he also found that, as he put it, the hand of the amateur has rested heavily on Lincoln studies, and he actually dismissed a lot of the early literature. Not that amateur historians have lent a lot to the field and have made some great contributions, but basically he's saying some of this is very amateurish, which is different from being an amateur historian. So basically what he found was that no, the theme has not been exhausted, and there still is a great deal to find out. About 40 years later, after this article was published, another Lincoln scholar, a man named Mark Neely Jr., who's since written a couple of really neat books, he surveyed the field also. In the very first issue of the Journal of the Abraham Lincoln Association, he wrote this lengthy article. And what he did was he basically talked about some of the things that had been done since Randall's article and some of the things that still needed to be done. He found that professionalism was the major development. That basically the Lincoln studies after Randall tended to be heavily focused on academia, that academic historians had really taken it on, and an awful lot of dissertations had been written, and there really were a lot of professional historians that were engaged in the field. He also found that a lot of new resources were available. For example, the Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln was published in 1953. Now, some of you, I know, are old enough to remember, as I do, that this was one of the things, and I think it's a 12-volume set, but I could be mistaken. Some of you may have it on your shelves at home. Because it was offered for quite a while by the Book of the Month Club. When you join the Book of the Month Club, you could either get the Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln, which is a nice little set, or that Will and Ariel Durant thing, the history of philosophy and everything else, that, you know, Will and Ariel Durant, yeah, okay. And so they offered it for years, literally, the Book of the Month Club. When you join, you could get one of those two things. So a lot of people had Lincoln on the shelves. I don't know how many people read it, but at any rate, for historians, for people doing work in the field, this is a tremendous thing, the Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln. All kinds of letters, speeches, and the like, and so, you know, a really great place to start. That had not been available years earlier when Randall was writing. There were also the Robert Todd Lincoln papers. Robert Todd Lincoln, of course, the only surviving child of Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln, and he lived to be a relatively elderly person died in the late 1920s, and he left all these papers, but they weren't available to scholars for a long time. Well, by the time of this second article here in 1979 or so, they were. They were on microfilm, and it was kind of hard to use. There are 97 rolls of microfilm, and so a tremendous amount of information there. There are also, and more about this later, 15 reels of the Herndon White collection, and we'll get into that in a little bit, and that was very important. Also, a whole lot of Civil War era newspapers. I mean, they've been languishing in basements of libraries and things like that, but in the years prior to the 1970s, the 1980s, a lot of these things had been microfilmed, had been cataloged, things had been kind of brought out of the basement and sort of rediscovered and stuff. They were available for scholarly use. But this guy also found out that there was a great deal that still needed to be done. A lot of that had to do with context. That is, Lincoln's cronies and people who were important in Lincoln's life. There were a lot of biographies that needed to be written yet, a lot of things that we didn't know about the people around Lincoln. Politics in the 1850s, also part of that context. The origins of the Whig Party, for example, the middle years of the Whig Party and the origins of the Republican Party had not been much written about, and that's something obviously in which Lincoln would play a role. Finally, the sort of setting of Lincoln in Illinois politics, kind of that local setting and what was going on in Springfield and Illinois in general and the Whig Party especially, and also his legal cases and basically Lincoln as a lawyer. And these things had been studied a little bit, but there's still a lot more work to be done. So this is, once again, this is back in the 1970s. Since then, a great deal of work has indeed been done along those lines, culminating, really, a lot of people thought, in David Donald's 1995 biography, I'm sure some of you have read it, it's just called Lincoln. Donald was the preeminent Lincoln scholar for many, many years, a professor at Harvard University who trained a whole lot of the people who are more currently writing Lincoln works, and a brilliant guy who won all kinds of awards. He just died, late last year, I think, and basically responsible for a lot of great Lincoln stuff. But since David Donald published this great book, kind of pulling together all of this research from the last 100 years or so, one enterprising historian figured out that there have been 300 major works published on Lincoln just since 1995, including some things very recently, just in the last couple of years, of course, leading up to the bicentennial. And the question for that might very well be why. I mean, if 75 years ago, Randall said, maybe we ought to kind of have a little bit of a hiatus here on all of this Lincoln stuff. Isn't it about time now, or wasn't it about time in the late 90s? And yet that seems to have just aroused this great new flurry of activity. And is there really anything that we still don't know about Abraham Lincoln? Well, that question, or I guess the answer to that question, why keep writing and is there anything we still don't know about Lincoln, is kind of illustrative of the whole process of history. And the way that history works and the way that we understand history and the way that we, pardon the expression, do history. New writings occur about all kinds of subjects. I mean, you might think this guy wrote the book on it, and then 10 years later somebody else writes another book. Well, what's that all about? New writings occur because new authors have a different way of looking at things. And new work sometimes even sort of changes the whole paradigm, the way we look at something. And this is usually based on two things. On one of two things, or sometimes a combination. One, new evidence. New evidence comes out that we didn't have before, and that changes the way we look at history at a certain time, or the way we look at a certain person. Secondly, a new, fresh interpretation of things that we already know or have already discovered, sometimes bolstered with new evidence, sometimes not, just somebody saying, let's take a fresh look at this, and interpreting it in a different way. And so that's really what's going on, basically those two kinds of things. And I want to talk about each of those things. I want to talk a little bit about new evidence in one particular case in Lincoln's life, and then a new interpretation of another part, of a very important part of Lincoln's life. The first bit, the new evidence, concerns that, what was that woman he had that love, of, not of an affair, but that great love for back in New Salem, and she died and all of that. What was that woman's name? Okay. See, I thought now, in a whole room full of historical-minded people, that everybody would sort of say, Anne Rutledge, and then I could say, oh, yeah, Anne Rutledge. See, you know about this woman. Okay. So, Anne Rutledge. Anne Rutledge is this kind of theme in Lincoln's early life that sort of runs through it. You all know about Anne Rutledge, right? Okay. So, really, what we're talking about is there's sort of like new evidence about Anne Rutledge, and I say sort of like because it's not necessarily brand new evidence, but it's kind of old evidence that's sort of newly admitted to the court of history. Old evidence that's been around for a while, but some people said that really doesn't work, and then it's sort of become part of the canon only more recently. Well, first of all, the story about Anne Rutledge. Anne Rutledge was the daughter of a tavern keeper and his wife, and she worked in New Salem when Lincoln was a young man. This is before he went into the law, before he went to Springfield, when he was trying to get a start as a shopkeeper and doing all of that sort of stuff and studying a little bit at night. And so Anne Rutledge was this evidently a comely-looking young woman. And she was allegedly, and there are some questions about this, engaged to a guy in the town in New Salem named John McNeil. He at least called himself McNeil there. It turned out later on that he had this sort of other life. His name was really McNamara or McNamara, and he had people back east. But at any rate, for the moment, she evidently gets engaged to this guy. So he tells her, well, you know, look, basically, I'm out here, and I've left my family back east. Now he's not married or anything, but you know his parents and a couple of siblings, and he left them back there. He's trying to earn some money to help them get out of debt and to save the old family farm and all of this good, wonderful, virtuous stuff. But in the meantime, he's got to leave. He's got to go back east for a while, Ohio or New York. The story's varied, and he's got to go back east, and then he'll be back, and they'll get married when he clears this all up and all of this kind of good stuff. So boom, he gets on the train and he's out of there. So then Abe starts kind of sniffing around, and it's evidently Lincoln had always talked to this woman, and she was a friend, and they were friendly, and all of this sort of thing. Now Lincoln started coming around fairly regularly, as the story goes, and basically the two of them became engaged, but only conditionally, because Anne Rutledge was a woman of honor, And basically she would not be engaged to two guys at once. And you didn't just break off an engagement. Nowadays you do, but then you didn't. And basically it was, you know, a very formal sort of thing. And so, well, let's wait till this guy comes back, or wait till I can find him and make contact with him and get out of that engagement, and then we'll go ahead with the Lincoln Rutledge thing. And so that's where it kind of stood, and that's what a number of people in New Salem thought at any rate. And then, of course, Ann Rutledge drank some bad water or something, got typhoid or one of those other horrible things in the 19th century, and boom, dropped dead. Abe Lincoln was just inconsolable. He went into this terrible funk. Several people wrote about it or discussed it at the time, this really awful depression, and it was based on the fact that Ann Rutledge had died, and that was just a terrible thing. Well, okay. Nobody, when I say nobody, I mean people in Washington, people in Lincoln's later life, Mary Todd Lincoln, people like that didn't know this story. They never heard this story. The story was known to a few people who lived in the area in this little tiny village of New Salem, which, by the way, the railroad didn't grace with its presence and was sort of at the end of a waterway that turned out not to be that navigable, and the town just literally died. All right, so Lincoln left and he went to Springfield and other people just kind of left and the town just died. Okay, but at any rate, as had Ann Rutledge, of course. But again, so, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of folks around who were following Lincoln to Springfield and, you know, telling their story and all of this sort of stuff. So it doesn't come out until many years later, after Lincoln died, in 1866. And it came out because his law partner was a scamp, a scoundrel, an interesting guy, named William Herndon, or Billy Herndon, as he was known to everybody. And the year after Lincoln's death, in 1866, Herndon decided he'd earn some money by going out and, well, and maybe it's not all self-serving, but it's, at least it's partially self-serving. He'd go out and earn some money by talking about his law partner, Abraham Lincoln. They'd been law partners for the better part of two decades, so Herndon figured, hey, who knew Lincoln better than I did? So he goes out and he starts giving lectures, and the lectures were very well attended, and people loved him. Evidently, he was a pretty good lecturer, but he also, he had the scoop on Abe Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln, remember when he died. I mean, he's our martyred president, and everybody can't get enough of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, it's this terrible story. And so basically, Herndon's out there, and he becomes extremely popular on the lecture circuit. And a big part of what he has to say is about Lincoln's background, because Herndon had actually done a lot of checking into the background, but also over the years, he talked to Lincoln. He and Lincoln had talked about all kinds of things in their early romances and, you know, guy stuff. And don't forget, in those days, in the early days in Springfield, Lincoln was all over the place. I mean, he didn't just practice law out of an office in Springfield. He and other lawyers followed the circuit judges and followed the circuit court. And so they spent a lot of time traveling around Illinois and a lot of time together and a lot of nights in saloons waiting for, you know, the next day for the court session and all of those kinds of things. So he and Herndon had evidently shared all sorts of intimacies and all sorts of knowledge. And so Herndon is out giving all of these talks. Now, here's the fly in the ointment about William Herndon. William Herndon absolutely couldn't stand, well, because she couldn't stand him, Mary Todd Lincoln. All right, the two were just oil and water. I mean, they were evidently Herndon had danced with Mrs. Lincoln at one point way back when, and he said something to her that she just took absolutely the wrong way and thought that he was just the slimiest little critter that had ever climbed up out of the river. And basically, she told her husband, this is the law partner, she said, that man will never come over my threshold, he will never come into my house. And they used to have parties of hundreds of people, and even at one point, 1,000 people were invited to this big political thing and everything else. Everybody in Springfield, everybody except Billy Herndon, because he never got an invitation into Lincoln House. He was not allowed in the place. Okay, so Herndon obviously had no love lost for Mary Todd Lincoln, so when he tells this story, he's embellishing it with all kinds of stuff, and he, you know, and basically it's all Abe told me, you know, Lincoln told me. Well, Lincoln told me was that Ann Rutledge was the only woman that he ever loved, and when she died, love went out of his life, and yeah, he'd marry later on, but only sort of out of convenience, and basically the love of his life was Ann Rutledge, and that was it. So part of this, at least, is to wound Mary Todd Lincoln. And so basically, he's around telling this story. Mary Todd got awfully upset about it, so did her son, Robert, and all of that sort of thing. Now, what's all of this based on? Well, he tells a lot of stories, and he tells a lot about all kinds of things based on a group of people from New Salem and other places early in Lincoln's life that have come to be known to historians as Herndon's informants. Herndon went all over the place tracking down these people. He wanted to know about Lincoln's early life. He wanted to write with authority about Lincoln's early life. So he knew a lot of stuff that Lincoln had told him, but then he wanted to find other people, you know, who basically would share their recollections and who would tell him what they knew, and basically he could get the whole story. So he becomes kind of this Freud of the frontier. He's trying to track down all these people so he can analyze, you know, Lincoln's early life and what's going on early on. So he collected all kinds of information from people who knew Lincoln early on, back in New Salem especially, to try to analyze Lincoln's background and explain his greatness. Explain how this guy, this rube, came out of the backwoods and turned into the greatest man in American history. And so that's kind of the task that Herndon set for himself. Well, now, you'd think that this Herndon's informant thing, I mean, this whole pile of information, would be a tremendous boon to future historians. Yeah, but, number one, all of the evidence flowed through Herndon. A lot of the people that gave evidence, many of Herndon's informants, for example, could not write. And so he'd go out and he'd interview them. And any interview that he did was all written out in his own hand, that basically this is what that person said. And of course he would ask leading questions of people, and he pretty much got the answers that he expected. So all of the evidence flowed through Herndon. All of it came to him in the form of letters which he passed along, or, you know, people filling out little questionnaires that he sent, or basically, again, him interviewing people and then his own transcripts of the interviews. And, of course, he was known to have an axe to grind. He just hated Mary Todd Lincoln, and that was that. And so anything about Lincoln's romantic life is going to sort of go against her. The other aspect of this that makes it kind of tricky is this is what historians have referred to as recollected evidence. Now, it's a little bit different. I mean, if I took anybody in the room, after I'm done talking and I interviewed you and said, wasn't that a great talk? What'd you like best about me? And, you know, then okay, you'd have stuff and it just came from right now and it's right there, it's right in the, you know. But if I waited 30 years and then basically came to you and said, okay, you know, what did I talk about 30 years ago on that night in October when it snowed? Well, chances are that your memory's not going to be quite as sharp about it as it is 5 minutes after the event is over. You see what I mean? And that's basically what Herndon's doing. He's talking to people about events that occurred 20 or 30 or 40 years prior to the time that he's talking to. And so this, quote, recollected evidence, a lot of historians look at this and they treated it, as one of them said in an article, as toxic waste. I mean, this is just stuff that, you know, there it is, but oh, be careful, you know, because you're not sure about this stuff. Okay. So there's that problem with the recollected evidence with Herndon's informants. And finally, the other, I guess, problem with this is that popular writers were so attracted to the romance of the story. And there were books by fiction writers as well as nonfiction writers that basically they embellished it into stupidity. And so, I mean, as will often happen when popular writers get a hold of things like this that are good romantic stories. So, let's start with Herndon's own biography of Lincoln. Herndon was collecting these things to write a biography, and he did along with another guy whose name was actually on another Lincoln friend named Ward Lamont. In the biography of Lincoln, he basically made the romance the centerpiece of Lincoln's life, and also kind of the Rosetta Stone to understanding Lincoln's character and what he became later in life. And the way he did that was basically he builds up this romance and how big it was in Lincoln's life, and then the death and how terribly that affected Lincoln. And it affected him in at least four ways. Number one, Lincoln turned away from religion. There was always this problem about Lincoln and religion, and did he believe in God, and basically he was not a member of any organized church, and Herndon finds that this is when he basically says, well, God has abandoned me, I abandon God, and turns away from religion. Okay, so that's one thing. Number two, he turned away from love. That basically Lincoln decided that, you know, he had love, he had found love, and she died, and that was it. And so while he did marry later on, it was basically a marriage of convenience. He was going to be a politician. Politicians were married and had families, and so he married this woman, and he had a family, and that was that, but he didn't really love her. Number three, Lincoln turned into, because of the death of Anne Rutledge, into a melancholy man who, try as he might, could never really find happiness or contentment. And a lot of people commented on that aspect of Lincoln, that he was this guy that had melancholy, that seemed depressed at times, that, you know, would get really down on things. And, of course, to Herndon, this is all part and parcel that came right out of Anne Rutledge's death. And finally, and probably most importantly, the idea that Lincoln turned away from domesticity. He turned away from private things, basically, and shifted his ambitions to public life. And this is what would make Lincoln great. This is what basically would get Lincoln out there as a speaker and as a person in public life, because he really had no real sort of closet there of other things in his life that were important. And so this all comes from the death of Ann Rutledge, and for Herndon, that's the big thing. That's really it. Well, actually, since it was Herndon and he knew Lincoln and other people kind of tended to accept this, because not a lot was known or could be found otherwise about Lincoln's early private life in various places. And so Herndon is kind of like the source, as well as these recollections of various people from over the years. So basically this kind of went on, and you sort of get that sort of idea about it. In the 1920s, well, this is kind of neat too, and we probably don't have time for all these asides, but William Randolph Hearst actually bought the site of New Salem in the 19-teens, and basically he wanted to make a little Lincoln Village out of it and started rebuilding and putting cabins on it and all of that stuff. And then some enterprising real estate developer sort of started digging around where the cemetery was, and what pops up at Ann Rutledge's grave. And so it just had this tiny little stone on it, and so they replaced it with this massive thing that had a poem by Edgar Lee Masters, who's one of the great poets in America in the 19-teens and the 1920s, and basically this great poem about, you know, here lies I, Ann Rutledge, and it goes on and on with dribble. But the guy who really, really, really did it up big and eloquently was Carl Sandburg. Now, I know you all know Carl Sandburg, the poet, and you're aware that he wrote this massive biography of Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, he loved nothing more than to get this flowery language and these expressions in literary terms. And so he rose to the height of eloquence in describing the romance between Ann Rutledge and Abraham Lincoln. And he describes at one point a Lincoln that is so hopelessly in love that, quote, a trembling took his body and dark waves ran through him sometimes when she spoke so simple a thing as, the corn is getting high, isn't it? The critic Edmund Wilson, who some of you may remember also, had a rather wry sense of humor. And he quoted this passage in one of his books about the Civil War literature, and he just ended it and he said, the corn is getting high indeed. Yeah. The corn was getting pretty high in the 1920s and 1930s about this whole romance business. In 1939 and 1940, we got a movie. In 1930, there are two movies. In 1939, Henry Fonda played Lincoln. In 1940, it was Raymond Massey in two big Hollywood movies. And in both of them, they used the Abraham Lincoln and Ann Rutledge romance as pretty much pivotal in Lincoln's life. Well, this goes on until the 40s, and then our old friend James G. Randall comes along. Randall totally debunked this stuff in the middle of the 1940s. He published a book called Lincoln the President, a magisterial book called Lincoln the President in 1945. And basically, in doing this, and in looking at Lincoln's early life and everything, he found some real inconsistencies in Herndon's informants and in what had been written about the Ann Rutledge business. So he got his wife Ruth in on it. His wife Ruth was also a talented historian and a graduate student, a young graduate student of his at Harvard named David Donald. Yeah, that same David Donald that 50 years later is going to have the big Lincoln book. Okay, he's just a grad student at the time with Randall at Harvard. And then basically they just researched the heck out of this Herndon material and did it extremely thoroughly and ended up, and he has this section, Randall has a section in his book in which he challenges every aspect of the Ann Rutledge story. He points to all kinds of inconsistencies in the informants where the story is based on, and basically says, you know, we have to just throw this out because there's no real proof of anything here. There's no proof that that Lincoln ever really went near the girl. I mean, they knew each other in passing and that was it. But there's no proof of anything, and this is all hearsay, and it's contradictory hearsay. It's all over the place. And so basically his wife Ruth wrote a biography, a very nice biography of Mary Todd Lincoln, and David Donald essentially wrote a biography of Herndon, in which he talked about how Herndon had created all of these lies because he hated Mary Todd Lincoln. And so this pretty thoroughly debunks that whole thing with William Herndon and the whole Ann Rutledge story. So for years after that, I mean, starting in the late 1940s, all of a sudden the Ann Rutledge story it was labeled myth and legend and fiction. And so whenever you picked up a book on Lincoln, it was, you know, if Ann Rutledge is mentioned at all, it's like, yeah, the myth of Ann Rutledge that used to get so many people for years and years and years. And so this is the history that, you know, a lot of people in my generation grew up on. Ann Rutledge wasn't real. That story didn't count at all. That was just one of those foggy old things from the past that I don't know how that happened, but that's out of the historical record now, so we don't believe any of that stuff. That changed in the 1990s. There were two articles that were published, one in Civil War History, the other one in the Journal of the Abraham Lincoln Association, and both of those are journals that are reviewed by experts in the field, by people who are not very willing to, you know, to take all of this Herndon's informant stuff at face value. But nevertheless, both of those articles were very informative about things and pointed out some things about the informants, which included, by the way, Ann Rutledge's own relatives, her brother, her mother, and a sister who lived to be a really old woman and who recollected pretty much the same stuff at the age of 85 as she had at the age of 50. And so basically there's, you know, pretty much the feeling that, you know, essentially when you re-examine all of these letters and you re-examine what Herndon found, you can put together a pretty good thread that indicates that the Ann Rutledge stuff is real. The conclusion that one of these authors came up with was that although the full story of Lincoln and Ann Rutledge will never be known, the reality of that story appears certain. And more than a century and a half after her death, when significant new evidence cannot be expected, Ann Rutledge should take her proper place in Lincoln biography. So once again, almost a half a century after Randall attacked the whole thing, Ann Rutledge is back. And she was back, interestingly, in David Donald's Lincoln. When he published that book in 1995, he grudgingly accepted the Ann Rutledge story. This one of the debunkers along with his mentor at Harvard. There was a very significant publication in 1998, Herndon's Informants, the book is called. The subtitle is Letters, Interviews, and Statements About Abraham Lincoln. It is available as a large book, 700 and some pages with all kinds of commentary. Also, interestingly, if you want to take a look at it, it's available online. Just Google Herndon's Informants, and you'll get the online site. And you can go in there, and it lists each individual in letters, and you can go in and read the letters, what this guy had to say about the Ann Rutledge thing. Or, it's not all about Ann Rutledge, all kinds of things about New Salem in the early days and Lincoln's early life. And it's pretty fascinating stuff. Even though these things remain what they were, their recollections 20 or 30 or 40 years after the fact, they're no longer really looked at by historians, it seems, as toxic waste. The biggest new publication on Lincoln was a two-volume biography by Michael Burlingame in 2008, and he uses Herndon's informants like it's absolute gold. Basically, he piles one source after another source after another source, and essentially that's what he's got, and he's going to stick with it, and he tells the story with those kinds of sources. So once again, this recollected evidence is kind of admitted to the canon of history. The judgment that's passed is that, yeah, we can use that, and yeah, if you're careful and you really examine the stuff and look for contradictory evidence here and there, you know, this stuff is really okay to use. And so, in a sense, it is new evidence that's been brought to light in the last 20 years or so, and basically it helps us to understand some of the influence of at least this particular past event on Abraham Lincoln's character. Probably not nearly as great an influence as Herndon indicated in his book, but nevertheless, it's an incident that really did occur, and it certainly had an effect on Abraham Lincoln in his early life. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. Are we running too late here? We got time for number two? Okay, the second thing is changing interpretations and how basically over a period of time our interpretations of things will change. And here I want to look no further than one of the most famous aspects of Lincoln's life and career, something we're all familiar with, at least to a certain extent, and basically that's what happened on November the 19th, 1863. What happened on November the 19th, 1863?
Well, I wasn't born yet, I know that.
Okay. He went out to a little place called Gettysburg and gave his address at the dedication of the National Cemetery. Now, we all know about the Gettysburg Address and what happened there. Number one, Lincoln was invited to give the address and he wrote it primarily on the train on the way. Number two, there was another speaker, a guy named Edward Everett, and he prattled on for hours and was boring and his speech is largely forgotten. Number three, Lincoln got up and delivered this brilliant speech. Everett went on for 2 hours, Lincoln went on for 2 minutes, and basically he nailed it right on the head and blew Everett right out of the water. And number four, unlike the silent response to Everett's speech, which the crowd didn't seem to really like at all, the crowd realized that Lincoln's speech was brilliant. The address goes down in history right away as one of the great things of all time, one of the great addresses of all time, and that's pretty much it. That's what we know about the Gettysburg Address, and practically everything that I said there is all wrong. Didn't exactly happen that way. All right. The great orator, Edward Everett, was invited to give the Gettysburg Address, or the address at the dedication. Lincoln, as it was pointed out, and basically just after he was invited, will also be present and participate in the ceremonies. Now, what that meant to everybody, and what everybody kind of understood, was Lincoln wasn't given the big address, and it was somebody else who was given the big address. Lincoln was going to be there and participate. He undoubtedly, as president, would say a few words, but that's all that anybody ever really expected. And so he's not really invited to give an address. He's invited to be there and say, hey, how you all doing? And that's pretty much the deal. As far as him writing it, mainly on the train on the way there, no. Some of it was undoubtedly done in the White House, and then some of it after we got there. There are kind of two halves of the speech, but there's pretty much pretty good evidence that he didn't do any of the writing while he was actually on the train. I even saw a thing some years ago that said that he was sort of scribbling it on the back of an envelope while he was in a carriage on the way out to do the dedication. It was like at the last second, oh, I think I better write something down. Well, that was nonsense, because that morning when he was at the house where he stayed overnight, he actually had written a copy of what he'd written before that he had before him when he gave the address at the cemetery. So it was all done then, and he had it there. But basically it was, again, started in the White House and finished probably in the house of a man named Wills, where he was staying before he set out. Okay, so that part of it is kind of not exactly like I described earlier. Edward Everett, this guy, this is a sad story, actually. I smile when I say it because it's a kind of a funny, sad story. Edward Everett was not just any speaker. He was not just any orator. He was the man. He was the guy. He was the greatest orator of the land. The mantle of Daniel Webster had descended upon Edward Everett, and everybody knew it. I mean, he's definitely the guy. And I have something to read to you that I know it's long and everything else, but have another sip of real coffee, not decaf. And then listen to this. This is incredible, okay? This was actually a part of an article on Edward Everett, and I thought it was so neat. It's worth reading the whole, it's one page, but it's worth reading the whole thing. Just listen to this, because this is one of the great name-dropping quotes you're ever going to hear. Suppose you had lived in the United States of America from 1794 to 1865, that was Everett's years, and that Daniel Webster had likened his half-century of friendship with you to a long streak of clear, blue, cerulean sky without cloud or mist or haze. Suppose further that Ralph Waldo Emerson had paid tribute to your radiant beauty of person, your rich tones, precise and perfect utterance, the most mellow and beautiful and correct of all the instruments of the time. What if John Adams had written on your behalf a letter of introduction to Thomas Jefferson describing you as the first literary character of your age? What if John Quincy Adams had confided to his diary that your orations were among the best ever delivered in this country and would stand the test of time? Imagine that Oliver Wendell Holmes had written a poem in honor of your inauguration as president of Harvard College. Assume that you had been well known to Presidents Adams, Jefferson, Madison, John Quincy Adams, Jackson, Van Buren, Tyler, Polk, Fillmore, Buchanan, and Lincoln. Then picture yourself passing the time of day with Goethe, Byron, Macaulay, and Scott. Think of yourself as Congressman, Senator, and Governor of Massachusetts, Tyler's Ambassador to England, and Fillmore's Secretary of State. Listen to such speakers as Daniel Webster and Wendell Phillips praise you as the golden-mouthed orator. Yet in just 90 years, suppose all these others were remembered and you forgotten. And the final straw, what if references to you were confined chiefly to contrasting unfavorably your two-hour speech at Gettysburg with Lincoln's two-minute masterpiece? You might have cause to ask the muse of history for another hearing. And I think that's just great. I mean, when you read this whole thing about Edward Everett, there was nobody like him around at the time. There's nobody certainly around like him today. I can't think of any other figure in American history that has such a distinguished, you know, list of accomplishments and achievements and friends, and it's amazing. And yet, that ending thing is exactly right. We don't remember the guy at all, except, oh yeah, he's the guy who kept going on blathering for 2 hours, you know, while Lincoln's waiting to get up and deliver his really important address. Now, let's talk about this 2-hour thing. 2 hours was kind of expected. Remember that. If I go for 2 hours tonight, I know there's going to be, you know, a problem. But 2 hours then, there wasn't any TV. There wasn't any radio. People weren't looking to rush home to do something. They came out to hear the greatest orator of his generation give a speech. And they would have, frankly, been pretty upset if he would have only gone on for about 40 minutes. I mean, they wanted to hear the whole kit and caboodle. They wanted to get the whole treatment, the whole thing. So 2 hours, that's pretty much the expectation. And they did not find it boring, not in the least. I recently read his speech. I never had until about 6 months ago. And it's pretty amazing. It's really pretty neat. First of all, it's researched very thoroughly. Oh, he has these classical allusions, and that's all a little boring to us, because we're not really classically trained, but many of the people back then were. All right, but he gets off of that pretty quickly. You know what he does? He gives us a history of the Battle of Gettysburg. He corresponded with Army leaders, well, the Union Army leaders. He talked to a lot of the local folks, local historians who were gathering information to find out exactly what happened. And again, he gets it from the military side and from the non-military side. And he's the first guy to sit down and say, okay, here's what happened. Here's the first day, and you basically got this happening, and the Confederate troops are coming into town, and Buford comes along, and, you know, I mean, just the Gettysburg story. And it's in the speech. And so, you know, it's the military history. It's a great and grand story, of course. And, of course, it's what they want to talk about because they're dedicating to the cemetery to the men that fought there. And so he gives this wonderful address with that. And then he talks a little bit toward the end about the constitutional aspects of the war itself and of fighting and whether or not the South has any constitutional right to leave and all of that sort of thing. Lincoln had seen that before the speech. He saw it in Washington before he left town, and he was pretty impressed by that, and he was even heard to go up to Everett and to tell him, you know, I never thought about this way, and this is really interesting, and it's a very nice treatment of the subject. And so Lincoln was pretty impressed with it. So basically, there's a great interest in this speech. The speech was extremely well done. One of the things that impresses the heck out of me is the two-hour speech, and again, it's full of all kinds of classical allusions, names. The guy memorized it. He didn't speak with notes. He always memorized the stuff. He memorized the speech. And he even had it memorized. He had a tough night the night before. He was in his mid-60s. He was only going to live for another year and a half or so after this time. And he was having all kinds of, he had bladder problems and various difficulties. And he was staying in this Will's house. And as it turned out, all these people came to Gettysburg to hear, for the dedication of the National Cemetery. I mean, so you've got all of these folks kind of rolling into town from all over the place. Well, they didn't have places to stay. I mean, basically, they hadn't booked ahead at the Holiday Inn. And so, you know, all the inns and taverns and private houses and everything was filled up. So now the Will's house, I mean, basically, they've got all kinds of people. It's a nice big three-story house. But they had an estimated 64 people staying there overnight. And so what ended up happening was that, you know, you didn't get to have a bed by yourself. You got somebody else shoehorned in there with you. Everett's daughter was there, and she was sleeping with two other women in the bed, and the bed broke, and they all ended up sleeping on the floor. So the only people that had a private bed in the house that night were Abraham Lincoln, who was staying in that same house, and Edward Everett. Well, they didn't bother Lincoln because he was, after all, the president and everything else, so they got to let him have his own bedroom. All right, but Everett... Late at night, this carriage rolls up to the door, and it's the governor of Pennsylvania, Andrew Curtin. And he doesn't have a place to stay, so he comes in. So they go to Everett, and they wake this poor old guy up, and they say, you know, we want the governor of Pennsylvania to bunk in with you. And he said, no, you know, I can't. I have all these problems, and you're very embarrassed and everything else. And so they tried like three times, say, you know, won't you consider, you know, it's the governor of Pennsylvania, you know. And no. So he confided to his diary that he actually laid awake for about 2.5 hours, worrying that the governor was going to be forced into his bed. So he had kind of a tough night the night before, but he still goes out and he gives what everybody described as this grand and eloquent and fantastic speech. Again, you can read it, it's wonderful, but I'm sure that hearing it would have been 10 times as wonderful. And there was a great deal of interest in the speech afterwards. It was reprinted continuously through the 19th century in pamphlet form and all kinds of different forms abroad and here, and he became quite famous, even more famous for this speech. As it turns out, there wasn't any cheering for his speech. At the beginning, there was an invocation on the part of the minister. Actually, the minister was pretty long-winded. John Hay, Lincoln's secretary, was along. And he said, Mr. Stockton made a prayer which thought it was an oration. That was kind of a nice little comment. All right, so Stockton does this, and then he sort of sets the tone. And the tone is very solemn. We're here to dedicate a cemetery. And so, and Everett's speech is rather solemn at the beginning as well, and he talks about the Athenians at Marathon, and he goes through all of this stuff. And so it is rather a solemn time. So people don't tend to cheer and everything. You know, he gets done, and there's this sort of silence that descends over the battlefield, which as much as anything else is kind of a reverence for not only the people who had died there, but even for what the man had to say, for the eloquence of his speech. So there's no big cheering and demonstration. You wouldn't expect that. So it's not that people were upset or felt that they'd been let down by the speech. Far from it. Pretty much exactly the opposite. Now, the fact of the matter is that when Lincoln got up to speak, there actually would be some cheering and all of that. And evidently, after Everett's speech was over, the mood started to change. The band played, and they didn't play, you know, happy festive music. They played this ode that had been written for the occasion. By the way, one of the band members at Gettysburg was John Philip Sousa's father. I thought that was pretty cool. But at any rate, basically, the mood kind of changed with the music and everything else, and people kind of got talking, and it's like, you know, they're over the hump, and the big speech is over, so what happens next? So when Lincoln got up, it really was a good bit different. Lincoln's purpose, as he pointed out, in going into this thing, was to console widows and orphans, to praise the dead, and to tell the people why they had to go on with this horrifying war. So he would do a few of the same things that Everett did, and Everett did some of those things as well, but of course at much greater length and with the whole story of Gettysburg. But basically, he spoke more in generalities to a considerable extent than Everett had, of course. He did not, however, diminish Everett's address. Everett spoke to the specific, Lincoln in general terms. Everett spoke of the battle, Lincoln of really the great things to come. And so it's really kind of two sides of the same coin in a way. The speeches were really complimentary, and Lincoln knew this because, as I said, he saw Everett's text earlier on, and so he was perfectly well aware of this. Now, actually, there was an outpouring on the part of the crowd. The crowd did start up, and it started with the second line, with Lincoln delivering his second or third sentence, and there was a one-armed vet in the audience. And when Lincoln first recognized the veterans and their contributions, this guy evidently looked up and he said, you know, he had the empty sleeve, and there's a certain amount of poignance there, poignancy. And he looked up and he said, "God Almighty bless Abraham Lincoln," and the crowd applauded. And then throughout the thing, when Lincoln gave one of his, usually when he paused or when he came to some really big part, there would be applause throughout his speech. The fourth thing that I noted was about the greatness of the speech and how it was immediately noted, and it simply wasn't. Not all the newspapers published the speech. It's obviously short enough, it's easily published, but not all the newspapers published the speech. One writer gives an example of a newspaper in Maine that thought what was much more interesting, the speech is sort of reported over in the corner, but the big story was reports of an 8-foot woman running through the Maine woods. And so, you know, that was interesting. That had something going on there. Okay, but at any rate, so even in some of the newspapers where they did reprint it, they didn't all get it correctly. Lincoln didn't hand out, you know, the speech and copies of it to everybody. And so not everybody got it correctly. They tried to kind of write it down. And so there are various reports about the speech and various speeches that are out there. The interesting thing about it, I always thought, was that Lincoln himself did not recognize at this point, he did not recognize the Battle of Gettysburg as the turning point of the war. Now, today, we really do. And so, you know, we look back at Gettysburg, and it's like, okay, this is the turning point of the Civil War. Well, it's still a little bit too close to it. Now, Everett sort of had that notion in his speech that this is kind of it. You know, the South has turned back, and now it's a matter of, you know, bouncing down south and continuing on and getting the war over with. But Lincoln didn't necessarily see that way, that this is the turning point. It's the war still has a good bit of time to go on. And so, basically, as it becomes clearer that Gettysburg was a real turning point, then the significance of the address is regarded as much greater. And that's something that would happen over a period of time, so it's not there immediately. Lincoln also did not recognize the address at Gettysburg as especially important. I mean, I think he knew that he made a nice little speech, that he had some nice phrases in there, that people generally received it well and were receptive to it. But he didn't think that it was a great speech of his career. He placed a great deal of emphasis. He said there were three speeches that he made that really were important. His first inaugural, where he talked about trying to avoid war. His second inaugural, where he talked about unifying the nation after the war was over. And the Emancipation Proclamation. That those were his great addresses. And Gettysburg, it didn't quite make the cut there. That was not one of the documents that Lincoln thought he would be remembered for. couple of strange things and kind of ironic is that the proclamation that created a holiday in October of 1863 was much more widely reprinted than the Gettysburg Address was a month later. What holiday?
Memorial Day.
Kind of strangely, in the middle of the Civil War, he signed the proclamation creating the holiday of Thanksgiving. It's basically after the big victories at Gettysburg and at Vicksburg, and there's been a lot of talk about it and a lot of people trying to get this declared a national holiday. And so again, as I say, his proclamation creating that holiday, creating Thanksgiving, was reprinted a lot more widely in newspapers than the Gettysburg Address. And one real irony of this, when we sort of contrast it with Edward Everett, and in a later period of time, it's like Everett's stuff is junk. Everett's address kept Lincoln's alive, because when Everett's was reprinted, so was Lincoln's with it. It's kind of a footnote. It's like, here's Everett's great address, and oh, by the way, here's this thing of Lincoln's. And so basically that kind of kept it alive and kept it out there and kept Lincoln's Gettysburg Address getting reprinted. There are no 19th century illustrations of Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address. No 19th century illustrations. There are all kinds of them as the Great Emancipator. There's one of them in the back, I think. That's the Great Emancipator. But there are no real illustrations of Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address. One guy tried, a New England artist. He was going to do it. He had this huge canvas. He was going to do Lincoln at Gettysburg. But he was doing it by subscription, you know, selling these ahead of time in order to get the money. He couldn't get enough subscriptions, so he dropped it. So in the 19th century, basically, the perceptions of the Gettysburg Address are a little bit different than they would be later on. All this hinges on interpretation and interpretations of what went on and what Lincoln said and all of that. Lincoln called for increased devotion to that cause for which they, the dead, gave the last full measure of devotion, and the new birth of freedom. And basically, at the time, Lincoln, and from the evidence that we have, Lincoln himself is thinking of this as kind of a footnote to the Emancipation Proclamation. Basically, the Emancipation Proclamation is his great achievement, it's his great document, it's his great gift to the world, it's why the war is being fought. And so this whole idea of the new birth of freedom, that goes right along. He doesn't want to say the word slavery because, you know, that's still controversial, even in the middle of the war. There's still slave states fighting on the side of the Union, as you know. And so basically he doesn't bring up slavery, but he's talking about it in these terms, which most people in the 19th century would have really understood. But over the years, after Reconstruction ended in the late 1870s and we get into the 1880s, and the idea of equality for the freed slaves started to fade and to disappear, blacks kind of drop out of history for a while. Until we get to the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and the 1960s, blacks kind of disappear from history in a whole lot of different ways. And basically, in the early part of the 20th century, people started to look very differently at the Gettysburg Address. And it wasn't about freeing the slaves, and it wasn't about black equality or anything like that. No, 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 no. It was about the same thing that a second inaugural was about the following year, and that was a call for unity, for the nation to unite, for the nation to go forward, and all of that sort of thing. And that basically is how the Gettysburg Address was viewed in the first half of the 20th century anyway. The popular image of Lincoln as the great emancipator was replaced with the image of Lincoln as the great unifier. The significance of the Gettysburg Address would grow with each generation as a great statement of who we are as a people, as a united people. This is a good example, I think, of what we might refer to as presentism. And historians have written about that. The tendency to take our own ideas, ideals, and values and layer them on history and interpret history through the prism of the present and of basically present values and present things. This leads to changing interpretations very often. They're not always correct. They're not always really good. They may be fallacious, but it's part of the process of history. Carl Becker, the great historian that many of you have read or are familiar with, wrote many years ago, about 80 years ago, he observed that each generation writes its own history. And that's part of what he's writing about. Each generation brings its own interpretation of the past. We have to be worried and concerned about presentism. That really is a fallacy. But basically, generations kind of change the way they look at things. Which leads me to conclude that there's no end to Lincoln studies. Lincoln studies are going to continue on. And frankly, that's okay with me. Lincoln's a fascinating guy to read about. The era is a fascinating era to read about. And so there are new books published every year. Hey, that's all right. Bring them on is basically what I say. Bring them on. But that's totally different from the words of after dinner speakers. They should be limited. We don't want to bring them on too much. And maybe we want to concentrate a little bit less on the words of the after dinner speakers than on what preceded those words, and that would be the meal itself. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what we ate. Thank you.
Have a nice day, Smith Board.